So tonight we're going to look at one of the really classic suttas. It's called the Satipatthana Sutta, Foundations of Mindfulness. And we talked both when we looked a little bit at the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses last year in May, and then when we started this series on the suttas that speak to us, that we don't really know what the Buddha said. He taught, his followers wrote, memorized some stuff, they passed it on to some other people for hundreds of years. Finally somebody wrote it down. And we have, 2,600 years later, these teachings that may or may not have been what the Buddha said. So the Satipatthana Sutta, we're pretty sure, is not one complete discourse that the Buddha sat down, started at the beginning, went to the end, and said, so be it. It appears to be pretty clear that this is a conglomeration of a bunch of different teachings that were thrown together by the compilers. But it has become the foundation, if you want to say it that way, of a lot of the way that people practice in Western Vipassana insight tradition. So it's really worthwhile to look at it. Now, we did look at this for about 18 months. Back in 2009, 2010, we actually took this thing apart into all of its little component pieces and gave talks week after week, starting at the beginning and going to the end, about how this thing works. Joseph Goldstein also went through the whole thing in his amazing clear and very deep style, and did the same thing. He gave something like 60 talks or something on the Satipatthana Sutta. And sometime around the end of our series came out with this book, Mindfulness, that we were not privy to when we did our series. So this is an amazing book. It sort of pulls together not only his thinking about the sutta, but also the evolution of his teaching. I mean, it contains a lot of the stories that many of us have heard people repeat from retreats and things with Joseph, but he's put them into book form here. And then we worked from this very scholarly book by a monk called Anālayo, called Satipatthana, The Direct Path to Realization, last time, but he's since come out with another book. So what he's done is that he has taken the teachings that left from India and went out into Tibet and into China, and then some of the Sanskrit fragments that remain, and he's compared all of these. I don't know how many languages he speaks, but it's pretty amazing. And the theory behind that is that if something appears in all four of those sources, it's probably something pretty close to what the Buddha said or what was written down very early in the process of what Tony Bernhardt calls this 2,600-year-old game of telephone. If it only appears in the Pali version, the version that's sort of come down to us as the suttas, then it may be that the compilers wanted to add some later things to kind of tweak the message to what it was, you know, 500 years or so after the Buddha actually spoke the words. So by doing this scholarship, he's actually found out that a lot of the things that are in the Satipatthana Sutta itself may not have been in the original version, because they aren't present in these other Tibetan and Chinese. They're called the agamas, like we call the Nikayas, you know, the Majjhima Nikaya, the Digha Nikaya, the Samyutta Nikaya. They call them the agamas, so the other versions of the suttas. So what I thought I would do tonight is reapproach this sutta. Now, obviously, when you have people, you know, this book by Analia was his was expanded from his PhD dissertation, and you know, this book by Joseph summarizes 40 years of teaching. When you have something that has that kind of depth, it's either delusional or arrogant or something to try to talk about it in one night. So the way I thought I would approach this sutta, because it is one of my favorites and I do revisit it periodically, the way I thought I'd approach it tonight would be as if in conversation. If we're in conversation with this sutta, and what does it have to teach us as a friend? You know, the Buddha talked a lot about spiritual friendship and the value of spiritual friendship. I think we feel that in this community. And so, what happens if we take the teachings themselves as a friend? So let's say that we were just starting a practice, and we went to this sutta and we said, you know, I keep hearing about all this mindfulness stuff. I think I'm interested in meditation, but there are so many kinds of meditation and mindfulness trainings out there. What do you recommend? And the sutta might respond, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four foundations. That's quite a statement. And dukkha is a Pali word for this just general existential dissatisfaction that we have with the way things are. Sometimes it's been translated as suffering, and you know, certainly at various points in our life we have known suffering, you know, with a big S. But that second word, discontent, is really closer to what is pretty much constant for much of our life. And that's what this practice is trying to address. The surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, and what we hope one day will be the disappearance of discontent. So that all sounds very nice and lofty, but where do I start? One of the first sections explains what the four foundations are. So it goes through all four of them and repeats it. I'll just use the body for this, the answer of where do we start. One abides contemplating the body, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. So let's look at those three qualities of mind. Diligent, which other people translate, and Joseph prefers the word ardent. Clearly knowing, and mindful. So this word ardent, I like because it has both the quality of diligence, of sort of application, of intention, of putting some energy into the practice, but it doesn't have that kind of self-punishing aspect of drive. You know, we're so driven in this society. And ardent has this quality that we're doing it because we're passionate about it. So that's the first quality of mind that we need to bring to the practice. We need to actually stay with it, but we need to do that because we're motivated out of some kind of passion, some kind of deep desire. And dukkha is a good place to start, out of a deep desire to lessen and eventually get rid of this dissatisfaction and discontent in our lives. This quality of clearly knowing, the Pali word for that is sampajanya, and it is It's one thing to hear a sound. Easy enough, doesn't require any effort. But to actually know we're hearing the sound, that's clearly knowing. That's actually applying the ability to recognize that we're knowing. So it's beyond just the plain knowing. It's clearly knowing. It's actually an awareness of knowing. And it's that level of awareness that we need to bring to our practice when we're working with these four foundations of mindfulness. And then the final one is mindfulness itself. Ardent, clearly knowing and mindful. So what do we mean by mindful? Well, the sutta goes on to explain in great detail, but really what we're looking at is remembering. It comes from the same root as remembering, and it's remembering to be aware. Remembering to actually stay with our present experience rather than wandering off into the future with planning mind or going back into the past with some sort of regret or remorse or rehashing of experiences that we've had, but actually staying in the present moment and connecting our experience, connecting what's happening in these four foundations that we'll go through to each other and seeing how they interact. That's the big picture mindfulness that we're talking about here. So, briefly, the four foundations are the body, which includes the breath, the feeling tone of experience, the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, an awareness of the mind itself, kind of mind state is present or absent, and then something that's called the dhammas, and we'll get into those later, but it's essentially the experience of phenomena. We'll talk about them when we get there. So the first one, still in answer to this question, where do I start, is, start at the beginning. Start with the first foundation. Start with the body. So this, the original version of the Satipatthana has, well, not the original version, but the version that's come down to us has this huge constellation of practices that can be done with the body. When Anallio analyzed them to see which ones were present in all of the various versions, turns out that only the review of the parts of the body, 32 body parts, the four elements, you know, air, fire, water, earth, and the corpse contemplation, the charnel ground, where in that day they would actually go to a place where the bodies were thrown out in various stages of decay and actually look at that. Those are the three that come down to us. So the other practices that are in the sutta that aren't in the agamas are noticing the posture, the standing, seating, lying, walking, lying down, noticing in daily activities, and even the very first one chronologically in the current version, the meditation on the breath is not in the other agamas. Now, there's an entire sutta on the breath, the sutta on the mindfulness of breathing, Anapanasati Sutta, and that does occur in the other versions, so probably it was, you know, in this other sutta, so maybe they didn't feel the need to have it in this one when it went to the other languages. And certainly, you know, there's value in noticing, being mindful of our posture, being mindful of our daily activities. All these things are very useful, but just pointing out that the original version didn't have them all. So let's look a little bit more closely at the three that were in all the versions and think about why they might have been. Looking at the parts of the body was an exercise in letting go of our attachment to the body as something that is kind of sexually attractive or that is being able to actually step away a little bit from thinking that this body is me, this body is myself. So the practice went through all the various parts of the body, including the internal parts of the body and the bile and the urine and feces and all that, as a way of recognizing that while we may think of this body as being this one solid thing, it's a reminder that really it's just a constant constantly changing form that isn't a solid, unchanging thing. You know, our hair turns gray, it falls out, you know, the blood changes, you know, its oxygen level. Some folks develop diseases, you know, that change the various body parts. It's something that's constantly in change. The elements are a way of breaking down experience into, you know, the four symbolic elements actually represent qualities of our experience. So the earth element represents the quality of solidity. So we can feel when we sit in the chair, and I say notice the contact of the sit bones with the chair, you can actually feel that solid support that the chair is giving us, and ultimately the earth via the rug and the floorboards and the foundation and all of that. Ultimately the earth is what's supporting us, that earth element. The water element is to notice the cohesion and the flow in things. So it enables us to notice when we're walking just kind of that feeling of flowing. And when things sort of stick to each other, you know when you're trying to pick up a small item like on the counter and you have a dry finger and you try to pick it up, it doesn't come up, but you know, you wet your finger and you can pick up. You know, for those of you that use contacts, right? There's a little bit of moisture on there. It really sticks. That's that quality of water is the quality of cohesion, holding things together. Fire is the quality of temperature. So the cool, the warm, you know, we were noticing in the meditation the temperature of the air on the skin and that sort of thing. That's the fire element. Well, that's fairly straightforward. And then the air element is it's sometimes described as being the way that things sort of hold up. And it's when we have a full breath of air, we sort of feel more erect and supported. And so it's the air quality is what holds things together as well. And then, you know, this corpse contemplation obviously is a meditation on impermanence, right? We may think that this body is going to last forever. We may think that our loved ones are going to be around forever, but they aren't. At some point, all of us are going to die, and everything that we hold dear is going to be lost. So, although we don't have charnel grounds anymore, we have plenty of opportunities to contemplate the reality of death. And that's really what's behind this contemplation. It's actually admitting that the one thing that we're 100% certain is going to happen to all of us, admitting the reality of that and not being lost in this delusion that somehow we're going to be bypassed by that experience. So just with the first foundation, you can see that we touch on some pretty deep insights. We touch on the fact that there's no permanent, solid, continuing self that never changes. We touch on the fact that experience is constantly changing. And we touch on the fact that at some point we're all going to die, and that this practice and that this life in a way are a preparation for that moment. So as we're talking to our friend about this practice, we might ask, you know, I'm kind of stressed out. Can you recommend anything to work with stress and trauma? I went to a day-long with a guy named Bob Doppel and with James Barras at Spirit Rock a couple weeks ago. And Bob is known for his work with climate change, but actually what he's working with more and more now is trauma. On the one hand, people who are working with climate change, people in government agencies like Health and Human Services, FEMA, Homeland Security, these folks are being traumatized by what they're actually seeing on the ground, the actual effects of that climate change is inflicting on communities in our country and throughout the world. And so they've developed what he terms a trauma-organized organization, where the actual way that they started to deal with reality is distorted by the fact that they're in trauma and not realizing it. So a lot of his work has been around actually noticing the fact that we are traumatized. And then on the other end, there are the folks themselves that are being impacted. And so he started to team with a woman named, I didn't write her name down. I'll have to get that. She has an organization called the Trauma Research Institute, and she's one of these people that, you know, flies over to Nepal the day after the earthquake and is working with the victims, and goes to Indonesia after a typhoon. And she didn't even realize that she was a climate change worker until Bob sort of got together with her and said, you know, really what you're dealing with, a lot of the work that you're doing in your trauma work is related to climate change. And so the two of them sort of cross-fertilized each other with their organizations and came up with some tools to help people deal with trauma. And one of the exercises that James and Bob did with us at this day-long was just working with pleasant and unpleasant in the body. It's working with the second foundation of mindfulness. The way it's worded in the sutta is, here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, one knows, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling an unpleasant feeling, one knows, I feel an unpleasant feeling. When feeling a neutral feeling, one knows, I feel a neutral feeling. So what the exercise that Bob did was to actually go into the body and consciously bring up the areas that are unpleasant, but not to get stuck there. To actually look for places in the body where we can sense something that's pleasant, and then allowing the mind to take refuge in that. Not to deny that the other is present, but to actually work with the feelings of pleasant in the body. And he calls this tracking. So he's sort of, kind of like Jon Kabat-Zinn, he's come up with another language that is very closely connected to the practice, but that makes it more accessible, like when he goes in to talk to government agencies and that sort of thing, to work with them. That same exercise is called pendulation in somatic experiencing. Those of you that are familiar with that modality of therapy, somatic experiencing. So this second foundation is actually being actively used to address trauma and stress in daily life and in the unusual and unfortunately much more frequent crises that are being brought about by climate change. So you might try that for a while, and then you might come back to your friend and you say, okay, I've tried those, but my thinking is really distracting. How do I deal with thoughts and thinking? The Satipatthana Sutta says, in the third foundation of mindfulness, Here one knows a lustful mind to be lustful, and a mind without lust to be without lust. One knows an angry mind to be angry, and a mind without anger to be without anger. One knows a deluded mind to be deluded, and a mind without delusion to be without delusion. One knows a contracted mind, or throat, to be contracted, and a distracted mind to be distracted. So the third mind, the third foundation, is actually mindfulness of the mind itself. So in the guiding that we did in the meditation before the break, I was asking you to actually notice what kind of qualities are in your awareness. Are you feeling joy? Are you feeling anxiety? Actually be aware of the mindful, the attitude of the mind toward whatever the present experience is. In this way, we're able to gradually get to know the territory of our own mind, gradually get to know the patterns that we use, gradually get to know the defilements, so-called defilements, you know, the hindrances that keep us from being able to practice with ease. We can tell the difference between confusion and clarity eventually, once we've experienced a few moments of clarity. We notice when we're in balance and out of balance, and what we need to do to bring that back. Those of you that are familiar with the three fires or the three poisons will notice in this, in the original description, that all three of those are present. So one knows the lustful mind to be lustful. That's greed. It's the first of them. One knows an angry mind to be angry. That's aversion. And then one knows a deluded mind to be deluded, and that's delusion or confusion. So essentially we're coming to know what it is that causes us to suffer. That's the whole task of this practice, is to get to know suffering. Get to know how it actually works in our lives. Joseph, when he talks about the third foundation of mindfulness, says, "The Buddha emphasizes knowing the presence or absence of the three unwholesome roots of mind and how they color or condition our minds." So that's why it's so important to notice the attitude of mind in any moment. Because our experience is always being filtered through that attitude of mind. You know, if we're feeling joyful in a particular moment, that's going to color our experience in a certain way. If we're depressed, that's going to filter perhaps that same experience in a very different way. So getting to know our own attitudes of mind, getting to developing the ability to actually be able to recognize the attitude of mind that's present in any moment is really a useful skill. And this third foundation is really being emphasized by a number of teachers now who are concentrating on teaching students mindfulness of mind, essentially. So one of those would be Sayadaw Tejaniya, who's a Burmese monk that has been teaching off and on here in the United States and now teaches all over the world. And his teaching is really spreading. In fact, at this day long, I sat right next to a woman who had just spent a couple months sitting with him in Burma and who knew some folks from Sacramento that were also there. So, kind of cool to see that spreading. Which might be the place to talk about the day long on Saturday. So what we're going to do on Saturday is to actually have our day long be in the style. I've also practiced with Utejaniya, although not in Burma. I only went to Massachusetts, so it's not quite as far. And then my teacher, Steve Armstrong, is also a student of Saita Utejaniya, as is Kamala, who was here at the end of February and did her day long much in this style. So our day long on Saturday will be about mindfulness of mind, and it will be mostly practice, mostly sitting and walking and whatever other postures people want to practice in. But throughout the day, we'll have some reminders of keeping in mind the attitude of mind. So we'll be practicing with that, you know, in addition to practicing with the body and the breath, as we always do. So those of you that want to come all day, that's fine. We'll be here from about 8:30 to 4:30. Those of you that want to just come for part of it, that's fine. We'll have quite an open structure. During any period, there'll be people sitting, there'll be people walking, doing different things. I may have some kind of timekeeping just so we sort of know where we are for those that want to use that, but there'll also be an open invitation for those that want to ignore the timekeeping to just ignore that and practice however they want. So it should be quite a flexible day. We'll do some mindfulness of eating at midday, and so I'd invite any of you that would like to join us for that to be here. But we'll learn a little bit more about mindfulness of mind at that day long. So the fourth foundation in this version contains a lot of those Buddhist lists. And so you may be going to your friend and saying, you know, all these Buddhist lists are driving me crazy. Can you help me decide which ones are the most important? And in the version that's come down to us, there are, let's see, 5 different Buddhist lists that are included. And then one of those is the Four Truths. And that's the fourth of those is divided into the 8 steps of the Noble Eightfold Path. So that's another list. It turns out that in the agamas, in the versions that came from the Pali, the only two that are present are the hindrances and the awakening factors. So when we did our meditation, I actually went through those lists. May not have recognized them because of the way I did it, but let's take a look at them now. So the hindrances, you can think of them one of two ways. You can think of them as being the things that prevent us from meditating, but Doug, who's sitting over here, has a way of talking about them as friends, our friends in meditation, because they actually show us where we're stuck. And if we can look, that's why it's so important to develop an ability to be with things that are pleasant and things that are unpleasant. Because these feel kind of icky. And when you're aware of them, these 5 hindrances don't feel very good, but they're our friends, because if we can be aware of them and stay with them, we eventually move through them. So the 5 are desire, aversion, restlessness, and worry. So restlessness is that sort of way that the body never seems to quite settle down, and then worry is the same thing in the mind. It's a back and forth of the mind, kind of a restlessness of mind. What's called sloth and torpor, kind of a funny words that were translated years ago, but sloth and torpor are the lack of energy in the body and in the mind. So sleepiness, drowsiness, haziness, fuzziness, all of those things would go under sloth and torpor. And then the last one, which I actually didn't include in the meditation, is doubt. And doubt is sort of a real showstopper when we allow it to get strong and we don't notice it. So doubt can be as simple as, why am I doing this? You know, in the middle of a meditation, what am I doing here? Why am I doing it? That sort of thing. All the way to, oh, this practice just doesn't work. You know, I'm giving it up. So it's really important to be on the lookout for those, because when they arise, just like everything else, they're impermanent. And if we can notice them, we have a lot better chance of moving through them and getting to another place. It's also important to know these in another way, that they're our friend, is that if we can notice which one of these show up more or less on a regular basis, we can start to learn our own patterns and the ways that we sort of impede ourselves in our practice and in our lives. So, you know, we can go from, I am an angry person, to, oh, there's anger arising again under these circumstances. Oh, there's anger arising again under those circumstances. Oh, okay. Turns out that when I feel like I'm belittled, anger shows up. And we've learned something. That's an insight. We were talking with somebody at the break. Insights don't have to be these giant thunderbolts that come out of the sky. They can be something as simple as, when somebody makes me feel smaller, I get angry. You know? So these hindrances, again, can be a friend because they can show us the unhelpful patterns in our lives. So these, this fourth foundation, which is called the foundation, the mindfulness of the Dhammas. Dhamma, at its simplest level, just means a thing, just a phenomenon. Dhamma with a capital D has come to mean the truth, or it also has come to mean the teachings of the Buddha. In this case, Anālio thinks that the best way to translate Dhammas is probably categories of phenomena. So you can think of all of these various Buddhist lists as categories of phenomena. The five hindrances are one category of phenomena. The Four Noble Truths are a category of phenomena. They're a way of looking at suffering and the end of suffering. The five aggregates are categories of phenomena that when we cling to them, cause a sense of self to arise. Mm-hmm. The other ones that are present, the six sense spheres, so the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, sensation in the body, and then thoughts in the mind, those are the six sense spheres. Those are also in the list. And then the other one that's included in the agamas as well as the Pali Canon are the seven awakening factors. So we actually went through them in the meditation. You may not have noticed. But there are three energizing factors and there are three calming or tranquilizing factors. And then mindfulness is the seventh, and it is watching that balance. It's watching if there's too much energy and maybe bringing the energy down, or if it's watching if there's not enough energy and maybe bringing the energy up. So mindfulness is the one that's noticing what's present, noticing what's not present, and bringing things into balance. So you can notice in this discussion of both the awakening factors and of the hindrances that it's all about conditionality. Anālio says that this fourth foundation, as it turns out, an interview with Anālio about Satipatthana just came out last night in the email that I get from the Buddhist Center for Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, and they just came out with an interview last night. I get the email every full moon, and just last night this thing came up where Anālio was talking about Satipatthana. I thought, well, that's timely, but he says that this fourth foundation is all about conditionality. It's all about noticing that things have causes and conditions and noticing how they roll out. So with the hindrances, noticing, oh, when anger is present, what's going on? What's that feel like? What are the consequences of that? What occurs when I see things through that lens of anger? And with these seven awakening factors, noticing, oh, what happens when I'm feeling sloth and torpor and I'm sort of, my energy's down. Can I bring the energy up with investigation. Maybe that's going to bring a little bit higher energy. Can I bring energy is actually one of the factors, but if we think of it as Tejaniya translates it as persistence, just staying with it, just having an attitude, but I'm just going to stay with this meditation for the entire 40 minutes. You know, I'm not going to give up and find an excuse to go off and, you know, add to my to-do list or anything. I'm just going to stay with it. Well, that's kind of, that perseverance is really a kind of energy, and it's an energizing factor. So, noticing the conditionality, noticing how we can actually change what's present in any given moment by being aware of our attitude of mind and of what's needed in a given moment to bring ourselves back into balance. So that's what the fourth foundation is about. Now, by the time you get through this whole sutta and you've read, you know, 32 parts of the body and this and that, different ways of working with the body, different ways of working with mind, and then all of these Buddhist lists, it can all feel kind of overwhelming. And I think anyone that's new to this practice, it's hard to remember to keep it simple. You know, there's so many books out there, there's so many teachings, and that's, this sutta itself contains so many different ways of practicing that it's hard to remember to just come back to the basics. Well, there's actually a nice way of tying everything together that's contained in the sutta, and it's just known as the refrain. Now, this thing's repeated 13 times in the Satipatthana Sutta, so you get the idea that the people that wrote this down thought this was pretty important. It's said, I've heard people that study Pali say that part of the reason there's so much repetition is that they don't have a whole lot of adverbs and adjectives that say very, 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 very this. You know, what they do is they repeat it. If something is important, they just repeat it to emphasize its importance. So this is the refrain. And again, since it's repeated 13 times, it's actually repeated after every single one of the sections to tell you how to practice with them. But they're identical except for the one word. So I'll use the body again for this one. In this way, in regard to the body, one abides contemplating the body internally, or one abides contemplating the body externally, or one abides contemplating the body internally and externally. Or one abides contemplating the nature of arising in the body, or one abides contemplating the nature of passing away in the body, or one abides contemplating the nature of both arising and passing away in the body. Or mindfulness that there is a body is established to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. And one abides independent, not clinging to anything in this world. So that's the practice. We practice internally, and these meanings kind of shift as you go through it. I mean, when you say mind, the internally and externally feels very different. Like with the body, it's easy to think of that as being internally being sensations that are inside the body, and externally as being sensations that are kind of external to the body or on the outside or maybe sounds or something like that. So you can kind of use these artistically, you know, use them creatively. But I'd encourage you, when no matter what you use as your primary anchor for your meditation, to try passing it through this little formula that's in the refrain of the Satipatthana. And see if you're doing that, if you're actually doing it internally and externally, and if you're watching for the arising and passing away. That's another recognition of impermanence, right? Watching how things arise and how they pass away. Noticing what's present, what's not present. That's a different version of that. Analeo says, in the model of Satipatthana that comes out of comparative study, which I discuss in my book, Perspectives on Satipatthana, we leave certain exercises that are found in the Pali version a little bit in the background. Then we have only these three body contemplations, anatomical parts, elements, and corpse contemplation. And we have only two in contemplations of the Dhammas, hindrances and awakening factors. Taken together, these are a massive package of insight that really covers huge topics that we are facing as Westerners. Three huge topics. The issue of being able to interrelate with others without latching onto sexual desire. The ability to let go of the separate sense of identity and see ourselves as part of nature, part of something larger, and be connected to that. And then the facing of our own death and being able to let death come alive in our lives. If you would do these three exercises seriously and let the insights really sink in, you would become a transformed person. And that's what this practice is about, is allowing it to work on us rather than we do the meditation does us until we come to the point where all of a sudden we realize I'm not suffering quite as much. I'm not causing others quite as much suffering. I've actually changed. I also got this in the mail today. Spirit Rock News and Schedule of Events. And there's a poem in here that I thought I'd end with by Wes Nisker. He's sort of the clown of the Dharma. He wrote a book called Crazy Wisdom, and he has a lot of it himself. So this is called Why I Meditate. And it's after Allen Ginsberg. I meditate because I suffer. I suffer, therefore I am. I am, therefore I meditate. I meditate because there are so many other things to do. I meditate because when I was younger, it was all the rage. I meditate because of Siddhartha Gautama, Bodhidharma, Marco Polo, the British Raj, Carl Jung, Alan Watts, Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, Alfred E. Newman, and Al. and others.
Et al.
Yeah. I meditate because evolution gave me a big brain, but it didn't come with an instruction manual. I meditate because I have all the information I need. I meditate because the largest colonies of living beings, the coral reefs, are dying. I meditate because I want to touch deep time where the history of humanity can be seen as an evolutionary adjustment period. I meditate because life is too short and sitting slows it down. I meditate because life is too long and I need an occasional break. I meditate because I want to experience the world as Rumi did, or Walt Whitman, or as Mary Oliver does. I meditate because now I know that enlightenment doesn't exist, so I can relax. I meditate because of the Dalai Lama's laugh. I meditate because there are too many advertisements in my head, and I'm erasing all but the very best of them. I meditate because the physicists say there may be 11 dimensions to reality, and I want to get a peek into a few more of them. I meditate because I want to remember that I'm perfectly human. Sometimes I meditate because my heart is breaking. Sometimes I meditate so that my heart will break. I meditate because a Vedanta master once told me that in Hindi, my name, Nisker, means non-doer. I meditate because I'm growing old and want to become more comfortable with emptiness. I meditate because it's such a relief to spend time ignoring myself. I meditate because my country spends more money on weapons than all the other nations in the world combined. If I had more courage, I'd probably immolate myself. I meditate because I'm building myself a bigger and better perspective, and occasionally I need a new window. I meditate because I want to discover the fifth Brahma Vihara, the divine abode of awe. And then I'll go down in history as a great spiritual adept. I meditate because I'm composed of 100 trillion cells, and from time to time, I need to reassure them that we're all in this together. Thank you, Wes. Comments, questions, complaints, reports from the field.
So, what do you think dealing with the mind outside and inside consists of?
The one that I found most useful, just for myself, is internally I'm noticing, you know, what's going through my mind and what's coloring my mind. Externally, I'm noticing what happens to other people when they're in certain moods. You know, if I talk to somebody that's really, really angry, what is it that they're talking about and what kind of assumptions they're making and that sort of thing. That's how I've used it. I don't know, have other people used it in a different way or found another meaning of internally and externally with regards to mindfulness of mind that's helpful? That'll have to do for now then. Know the confused mind to be confused.
Thank you for doing that in that summary of everything, because the summary of the list, the summary of what's essential, and going through again one more time the ways in that you're doing that balancing act and going in, because I know I've been wrestling with that in my own meditation in the last few weeks. Instead of viewing a troubled mind as being a friend, and I've just been aware of the trouble, so it's useful to get reminded again that there's this balance that goes on.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really useful to revisit these. And they stuck around for 2,600 years for a reason. They've been helpful to people. It's not doctrine. I mean, we don't have doctrine, so it's not like you have to believe this to practice. But it's really helpful every once in a while to revisit these. The last talk I gave on the Satipatthana was September 2010, and I just pulled it up just for the heck of it to see if there'd be anything useful. No, there wasn't anything. Because, you know, perspectives have changed. I've done a lot of study. I've changed as a person. My practice has changed. So, just don't assume that because, you know, you've read it once, you've gotten everything there is to get out of it. So much more. And then, you know, that can be freeing, right? We can remembering the troubled mind can be a friend is freeing.
And not just bad meditator.
Right. Not just bad meditator. That's right. Yes?
I wanted to add, when you were speaking of those talks, they're not currently on the new website, but they are available at the right info at sectoinsight.org. They're available. So we have talks all the way back to 2008, I believe. So if somebody's interested in that whole series,
great,
it'll be there.
Thank you, Brian. All right, well, why don't we close with just a recognition that, yes, the coral reefs are dying, and yes, there are storms ahead, but by our intention to come together as a community and look at that, look at what's unpleasant along with what's pleasant, to become familiar with our mind and our own unhelpful habits, we also uncover the ability to feel real joy, to feel real connection, to be moved to service. So in closing, let's dedicate whatever positive energies we've generated by our practice and our good intentions together to, in some real way, reducing the suffering in the larger world, knowing that there's no way we can predict all of the ripples that our behavior touches, wishing all beings to be safe and protected, wishing peace and happiness for all beings, wishing a true sense of ease as we engage the world, and wishing that all beings will be free of suffering. Thank you for your practice.